From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The latest tactic in the battle of the sexes may be to use biology, behavioral research, and brain science to declare women the victors. We'll talk about a controversial book called Women After All on today's show. And we want to start with a conversation about gender roles in our society. Do you think they're changing? Is it useful to compare the abilities of men and women when it comes to, say, political power or parenting and other social concepts? Here are your first thoughts.
This is Greg O'Driscoll. I'm calling from Blackshear, Georgia. Basically, isn't it possible that there's a pendulum at work in human society? They talk about a lot of early prehistoric civilization being ruled by women or by a priestess figure, which is represented by the Earth Mother, and how it was eventually supplanted by a Sky Father figure, where we saw an ascendancy of male power and patriarchal religions, which we still have a lot of today. Maybe a new model for spiritual or psychological, or perhaps a Jungian or even an approach similar to that of Joseph Campbell. We need a new model for our society that is cooperative. And if we have that, perhaps we have more cooperation between the sexes.
Sam Burnham also tweets, "One day we'll think of people as individuals, not races or genders. Until then, we'll have inaccurate debates based around generalities. Some people are naturally superior, but it's about intelligence, giftedness, etc., not race or gender." We always love getting your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OSD Talk, or you can post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Omar Mateen took 49 lives and injured at least 50 in an Orlando nightclub earlier this month. That is the deadliest massacre by a lone gunman in American history. An investigation by Mother Jones magazine found 90% of all mass shootings since 1982 were committed by men. Why are so many of these killers male? Today we'll spend the hour looking at the biological differences between men and women, and we'll talk about a theory that women are actually the superior gender. Now, the role of women in society has undeniably changed. This wouldn't be considered comedy if that weren't true.
An ordinary dinner party, the sort of occasion we all enjoy. The men are exchanging witty stories. And look at the women, aren't they pretty? Look at the way they laugh, they're delightful. But now the conversation turns to more serious matters.
I wonder if the government should return to the gold standard.
I think it should.
Good, then we're all agreed.
But oh dear, what's this? One of the women is about to embarrass us all.
I think the government should stay off the gold standard so that the pound can reach a level that will keep our exports competitive.
The lady has foolishly attempted to join the conversation with a wild and dangerous opinion of her own. What half-baked drivel. See how the men look at her with utter contempt. Women, know your limits.
The gender gap is closing. But what if that progress also signals a bigger change, a complete shift in power from men to women? That's the argument an Emory professor makes in his book, Women After All, Sex, Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy. Melvin Connor is a professor of anthropology and of neuroscience and behavioral biology at Emory University. I spoke with him back in November, and I began by asking him about the book's controversial premise.
This is, as I said in the introduction, has something to offend everyone. It's bound to offend a certain kind of man who hasn't gotten with the program yet, figured out that things are changing faster than they can control, and they're changing for the better. Some controversy among women who think I'm too optimistic about how fast things are moving, and I think I can defend myself on that. On that point as well. And also, there's, you know, since the beginning of feminism 150 years ago, there have been a feminist who insists that women need more influence in power and in life and government because women are different. And that's kind of called difference feminism. But there are also a lot of feminists today who don't like any hint that there's some biological aspect to the...
Right, they want to imagine complete equality. There was actually a recent study that showed that men throw better than women, for example, throw like a baseball better than women, and there were a lot of women very upset about that. But your book doesn't deny some inherent differences between men and women, correct?
Right, and emphasizes particular ones. But by the way, one of my students had released from an exam, so she could go on pitching championship games on the softball team at Emory. They are the division championships already.
Okay, enough plugs
already
for Emory's athletics there, Mel. But help me understand exactly where the biological basis is. What interested me was you talked about, you go back really to the very, very beginning and ask this question, why did the humankind need men at all? Right? Is that correct?
Right. I mean, it really goes back before humankind to the beginning of animals. The first little animals, really one-celled animals, were reproducing from their own bodies. So they were basically females. So question came up for biology. Why did those first females ever invent males? I mean, what an idea. You have this whole other kind of a member of your species that can't reproduce. What good is it? And the answer just seemed to be that it mixes up the genes and that helps protect you against germs and parasites. Once you've done that, a lot of things happen, and you get males who become competitive over females. You get males who become physically aggressive in many species. And when it comes down to us, we have a long legacy of that. We have a long legacy of males being physically violent and also very very driven and compulsive in their sexual
enthusiasm. Right. I'm going to play you a little bit of Luann Brizendine speaking. She's a neuropsychologist. She's the author of the very popular books, The Female Brain and The Male Brain. And here she is speaking during a TED Talk in Berkeley, California.
Just sawed off the top of our brains, the male and female, there's all kinds of little areas that marination and testosterone cause some areas to grow larger, some areas to shrink, and the female without the testosterone, some of her brain circuits developed in different ways. Now, you all know that the male and female brain are more alike than they are different. After all, we are the same species.
So she has spent a good portion of her career talking about the actual differences that occur in the brain because one is awash in testosterone. Can you, in a way that I can understand, help explain what are these differences that occur in our brains because of these hormones?
Sure. Well, as she said it very eloquently, I agree completely with both of the points she made. First of all, male and female human brains are overwhelmingly similar, 99% probably similar. But we are finding... scientists like her are finding more small areas where the differences are there, and they matter for certain particular things. So, for instance, there's an aggression center in the brain called the amygdala, which is larger in men, and we all know men are awash in testosterone, like she said, and we're talking about physical aggression,
right?
Violence, not verbal aggression, not competition, not achievement motivation, just hitting and kicking and shooting and stabbing and bombing, that kind of aggression. And that part of the brain that does those things or generates those things is not only bigger in men, but it's very responsive to testosterone, which men have 10 to 100 times more of than women. So that's a significant bias in that area of life and behavior. And furthermore, we have another part of our brain that that inhibits the amygdala. It inhibits the violent tendencies, the hair trigger
kind of
reaction
down.
That just says, wait a second, not yet, let's think this over. And that's the thinking part of the brain, the frontal lobes. And women have more suppression of that violent impulse from their frontal lobes.
Yeah, we may get angry and think, I want to kill you, but then we think, wait, hold on, that might not be the best idea. So I want to, I mean, we have a few minutes left. We have the whole hour. But before we bring in some other people to discuss this, your thesis, and please correct me if I have this wrong, your claim is that while in the past men's genetic differences have made them, their physical power, their physical strength, able to dominate, but now that society has changed, now that some of the characteristics that women have inherently are more valued and more necessary, that means the balance is going to shift. Is that accurate?
I agree. That's it completely. We've been through thousands of years of history where it mattered that men had greater physical strength for many tasks, but especially for fighting in wars, for protecting the family and so on. It mattered that men had a willingness to go to war in order to protect the village, to protect the nation, and their muscle was needed to do a good job of that. But now their muscle becoming less and less important. We have more and more things done by machines. We have more and more things done with technology. Women fly Apache attack helicopters and the F-16s, and they deploy more force by pressing a button than a whole Roman army could have deployed with their muscles and swords. And not only that, but they can even sit at a consul in Colorado and make an attack on a terrorist in Afghanistan or Pakistan by pushing a button or jiggling a joystick. That doesn't need muscle. It just needs brains and training and a sensible approach to life, and that, to me, is what women are like.
Since you brought up Apache attack helicopters, I should mention that studies out of the Army have shown that women are actually safer and often more agile pilots than men, with their way fewer female chopper pilots, but they tend to have fewer accidents, only 3 out of 100 accidents.
Why am I not surprised? You know, there's this old thing where men were so sure that women are bad drivers, and you still hear that from men today.
Yeah, you do.
Statistics show absolutely clearly that women are better drivers. They're safer drivers. They have much fewer accidents, especially in the younger and older ages. But throughout life, women have fewer driving accidents.
That's why our insurance is cheaper.
Exactly.
We're going to continue this conversation, and I know that many of you out there have thoughts about this. So we want to hear them. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. My guest this hour is Melvin Connor. Dr. Connor's book is called Women After All, Sex, Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy. We're going to continue this discussion about the differences between men and women biologically, sociologically, and suss out whether there actually is a dominant sex after all. And we're also going to enter that naughty problem of nature versus nurture. So stay with us. It's all coming up after a short break. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Is there a biologically superior gender? We are exploring that question and others related to it with Emory Professor Melvin Connor today. His new book is called Women After All, Sex, Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy. It makes the controversial claim that women at this point in history are biologically designed to be the dominant gender. So joining us now to continue this conversation about men and women, I hate to reduce it to the battle of the sexes, but that's kind of what we're talking about on a scientific scale. A group of smart experts. Philip Cohen is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. Hi, Philip.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Kimberly Hamlin is the author of From Eve to Evolution, Darwin, Science, and Women's Rights in Gilded Age America. She's also the director of American Studies at Miami University. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks so much for having me today.
It's good to have you as well. And here in the studio with me to join Mel is Roxanne Donovan. She's a psychology and interdisciplinary studies professor at Kennesaw State University. And Roxanne, it's good to have you as well.
Hi, Celeste.
Let's get into it, shall we? So let's start with this question of nature versus nurture. And in your book, Mel, you talk about the ratio of how much nature versus nurture contributes to our sort of gender-specific qualities. What did you end up, what was your final sort of takeaway from looking into how much is nature and how much is genetic?
Well, if you look at all the differences between males and females, men and women, I would say the vast majority are nurture. The vast majority are cultural. You and I walk down the street or sit here together. We're dressed differently. Our hair's made up differently.
Yeah.
There are tons of things about the way we act because of the way we've been brought up and the way we speak and the habits we have. None of that is rooted in a biological sex difference.
Let me play another comment here then from Luann Brizendine, the neuropsychologist we heard from earlier. This is her discussing this very topic.
We all absorb our culture and what people tell us what we're supposed to be doing, our parents, our churches, our education. So our circuitry in our brain may become primed into the world to be developing in the male direction or female direction. But at least half of our circuits get built also by the gender learning we do in our culture.
So let me take that to you, Kimberly, since you've written about Eve to Evolution. Mm-hmm. She says half is genetic and half is culture. What's your response to that?
I have two responses. The first is I think this nature-nurture divide is actually a false binary, and this is perhaps more Dr. Connor's area of expertise, but I think the new field of epigenetics really shows how, you know, nature and nurture influence each other and are not, in fact, entirely separate, as we've been so often told. My second response to that is as a historian. So in From Eve to Evolution, I talk a lot about some of the 19th century debates about biological sex difference, including those that focused on the differences between men's and women's brains. So because I've studied so many of these historical debates about differences in brain, I'm a little leery of continued emphasis on the differences in male and female brains, and I think we should put those in historical context. So for example, a lot of the differences we still hear about today are oftentimes very familiar 19th century theories that get dressed up in new language or with new technology, such as, you know, fMRIs today. And one of the women that I chronicle in my first book and who I'm writing a second book about now, Helen Hamilton Gardner, really pioneered the feminist application of science to brain difference studies. And she was so committed to this that when she died in 1925, she donated her brain to Cornell University's Burt Wilder Brain Collection, where it remains on display today, to prove that women's brains were not, in fact, inferior to men's. So I just think we should have a little historical context when we think about these longstanding studies that emphasize difference when, in fact, as Dr. Connor and Luann Brizendine say, they're really 99% similar.
And yet there are important differences. Let me bring you into the conversation, Philip. And any of you should feel free to break in should you feel passionate about something. But we have seen study after study, Philip, in which we have seen the ways in which women and women behave in the military is different. The way men and women behave as parents is different. The way they behave as bosses, as employees, that these are all inherent different. Even the way they learn in classrooms very often is different. So how do you account for that?
Well, I would slow you down at inherent there. Like Dr. Connor said, you know, we have a lot of observable differences between males and females and men and women, and the origins of those are often quite hard to tell. So one way to think about this is how big is the biological effect you're sort of talking about, whether it's genetic or hormonal or epigenetic.
Epigenetic is something that Kimberly said as well. Okay. Can you explain? You're leaving behind all us non-scientists.
That just means that things that are genetic and in our genes are influenced. The genes are turned on and off by experiences that our bodies or have either in utero or after we're born. So the way
I say it is that your experiences really get down into your genes.
Oh, there you go.
Right. But just think of it as biology is fine, and to say, you know, how big is this difference? So we may have an average difference, but there's always a lot of overlap. You know, the there's a lot of women are taller than a lot of men. You know, a lot of women are more aggressive than a lot of men, even if the averages skew on those two dimensions in men's favor. And then the other question is, how mutable are they? So if we have an underlying tendency for a more average level of physical aggression on the part of men, or more average level of nurturing behavior on the part of women, how much does our social organization and social behavior affect those levels? And I think there we can see huge differences. And I think the historical context is important, but even in more recent history, you know, some of the key indicators that we have to look at gender differences, say women in managerial occupations, you know, it was half a century ago, it was only 10% of the managers in our economy were women, and now it's about 45%. Or we had labor force participation, women in the paid labor force, down below a third a half a century ago, and now up to about three quarters. And you can sort of go through the range of things that have changed and see, you know, in the biological blink of an eye, how much we've changed. Oh, and also how much we differ across societies. You know, the United States is really a laggard in many respects, unfortunately. So we have about 20% of our national legislature is female. But if you look around the world, you know, it's up to over 40% in countries as diverse as South Africa and Sweden. And it's way down around zero in countries like Egypt or Iran. So there's just a tremendous amount of influence that we can have.
There's also tremendous dynamism. And there are African countries that have a quota for women in the parliament that's much higher than our representation. But on the other hand, and, you know, I'm old enough to remember when the number of women in the Senate was zero, and now it's 20. It's been rising steadily throughout my life.
It's clear. There's, it should be 51 if it was going to accurately reflect.
Yes, but at the rate that it's going, I don't know that we're going to wait that long before it's 51.
Actually, at the rate that it's going, we're going to wait a very long time before it's 51. But it's certainly within the realm of the possible.
Well, let me bring Roxanne in, who's been very quiet, because, I mean, you deal with psychology, and I don't want to leave this whole idea of nature versus nurture behind. If we accept it, have we left behind, as Kimberly suggests, should we leave that whole debate behind?
I think Freud started by saying anatomy is destiny, and we've moved very far away from that to understanding that the environment plays a really important role. So the path from biological tendency to behavior is really complex, and it's influenced, and I think everyone said this, by socialization, by culture. And it's hard for us to really understand the role of socialization because we can't pluck someone out of their society, have them grow in a different society where women are the dominant group, and then assess how they behave, right? So in the society that we live in most societies of the world, there's a social dominance hierarchy with men on top. So how women behave is based on that hierarchy, right? So women are much more likely to be caregivers because that's not valued as much, and leadership is more valued. So you see men overrepresented in leadership groups. And all those have psychological ramifications to how you engage with other people, how you act with other people. But in psychology, there has been consistent findings that aggression and sexual differences have come up with great, I should say, moderate magnitude. These differences are being found fairly regularly across studies. All the other differences, the magnitude, how big the difference is pretty small in the way that Philip just talked about. So what might be going on in the areas of aggression and, as Mel talked about, seeking sexual activity? So what's going on with that? Why is that difference still coming up? Is it how we socialize boys and socialize girls, or is it something else?
Or a combination.
Exactly.
Let me real quickly play a clip here. This is a comment, I guess, on what has been the priority in trying to get equal rights here.
There was a moment in time when we focused on affirmative action, getting women into the workplace, but we didn't focus as much on what happened to them once they got there. So, yes, we've had some examples of women breaking through the glass ceiling. But in many, even the most highly paid professions, there's been a resegregation so that even in those professions, men tend to be doing better than women in the more highly paid positions.
And that is NYU sociology professor Kathleen Gerson. She was talking about her book, The Unfinished Revolution. And before we respond to that, I just wanted to lay out a few statistics that I think you guys, all four of you, are probably well aware of. In fact, they've done studies on who are better bosses, and whether it came from Harvard University or elsewhere. Now, globally, women make up about 9% of corporate board membership, so still extremely low around the world. And most stereotypes make people believe women leaders would excel at nurturing, what they call nurturing competencies, like developing other people, developing relationships. And when they've studied it, they found women do actually excel at those things. But they also discovered that they were better at things like taking risks, taking calculated risks. They, in fact, women rated higher in fully 12 of the 16 competencies that go into outstanding leadership. And I'm quoting here from this Harvard study. Two of the traits women outscored men to the highest degree, taking initiative and driving for results, have long been thought of as particularly male strengths. And Mel, this seems to me to fit perfectly into your argument about the differences, wherever they come from, the differences between men and women, that what's needed now in today's society is perhaps leaning more towards the female.
Right. And so let's remember what was said a very short time ago and still said by a lot of men. Women are too emotional. They're too sensitive.
Yeah.
They have these hormonal cycles that are driving them nuts, once a month or... And the flow and ebb of these hormones mean that they can't concentrate and be... Well, we can now turn that on its head. We know that those hormones do not affect most women's judgment at any time of the month. And on the other hand, we know that men's hormones, especially testosterone, which don't come around like clockwork, they come around at random, cause tremendous destructiveness. They're the things that derail the governor of New York and the governor of South Carolina and the president of the United States. And
are you talking about sex scandals here?
I'm talking about sex scandals and the also the things that put a male all male or almost all male governments on a hair trigger for violence and war. Those are the hormones that you should worry about, not the hormones of the menstrual cycle. Right.
To that point, let me play you a comment. This is from Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. This was from last year on his show, The O'Reilly Factor. He's talking to political pundit Kirsten Powers. Take a listen.
There's got to be some downside to having a woman president, right? Something. Something that may not fit with that office, correct?
I'm going to say no, Bill.
Well, men are said men are men and women are women, and there's a difference. Okay, there's a difference between the genders.
Okay, so Philip, help me understand here how we persist. If it's true that what Mel was just saying, and I don't want to repeat everything that he just said about the difference in decision-making and hormonal changes, why does this persist, this idea that women are just too moody?
Well, I think if you think about our inherent capacities and their relationship to what we actually do and achieve in our lives, the important thing to realize, I think, is how little any of us are fully realizing our inherent or biological potential. So that, you know, a tremendous amount goes into influencing. You can always get hung up looking at the extreme tales. I mean, the women who lead Fortune 500 companies are off the charts on their managerial skills and competencies. The athletes in the Olympics, the fastest man in the world is, you know, faster than the fastest woman in the world. But for most of us, you know, we never achieve.
But the fastest woman in the world is faster than almost every man in the world.
Exactly. And for most of us, we never achieved we never ran as fast as we could have if we'd started at a young age. So if you look at the way we organize, we take those attitudes like Bill O'Reilly's. I mean, we have 98% of preschool teachers are women. 3% of construction workers are women. So we have, you know, we could, if we were, if our society was organized around maximizing the potential of individuals, I'm sure we would find more than 2% of men who could be preschool teachers, and at least more than 3% of women who could be better construction workers. But we have this very strong categorical attachment. So we attach this idea of men are more like this this and women are more like that. And we'll put a weaker man in a construction job and a stronger man in a preschool teaching job because that's the way our society organizes gender.
So we are going to continue talking about that in particular, but we have to take a quick break. I want to just remind you, we're talking about the differences between genders biologically, sociologically, and all those other ways, and whether one, specifically women, at this moment is superior to the other. I'm speaking with, you just heard the voice of Philip Cohen. He's a sociology professor at the University of Maryland. Also, Kimberly Hamlin is the director of American Studies at Miami University. Roxanne Donovan is a psychology and interdisciplinary studies professor at Kennesaw State University. And the launch for this conversation is Dr. Melvin Connor's new book called Women After All. He is an anthropologist and sociologist at Emory University. We are going to continue this conversation after a short break, and we want you to weigh in as well. Give us a call at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought. Stick around. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We are talking about gender differences, gender biases, gender superiority today. The new book, Women After All, Sex, Evolution, and the End of Male Supremacy, says women are at this point the naturally superior gender. The author is Dr. Melvin Connor. He's my guest this hour. He uses evolution, genetic research, and cultural examples to support his claim. We're also joined by Roxanne Donovan, a psychology and interdisciplinaries associate professor at Kennesaw State University. Philip Cohen is sociology professor at the University of Maryland. And Kimberly Hamlin, author of From Eve to Evolution, directs the American Studies program at Miami University. Lots of big brains in the studio today. Before we went to a break, Philip was talking about the fact that most of us do not actually live up to our potential. And you, Mel, had a particular response to that.
Yes, I agree with Philip that I have to say that it's much more stunning to me that for thousands of years we've been, as a species, we've been wasting half the talent in the human race. Half
Absolutely.
Of all the talent in the human race has been kept out of most of the arenas where it can be shown. You know, that BBC comedy piece that you played at the beginning, Celeste, this woman makes an observation about the gold standard and they make fun of her. Well, guess what? Christine Lagarde is head of the IMF. She's the one who determines about what happens with the flow of money throughout the world. Janet Yellen is the head of the Fed. In both cases, the first women to occupy that job. How are they doing? They're doing great. Where's their hormones derailing them from being able to make a complicated speech about the banking system? Where's the moods that are supposed to interfere? I mean, that's ridiculous. Nobody thinks about that anymore. And that's the most important thing about the women heads of state, the women senators, the women CEOs. Yes, they're small in number, but they're doing a good job. You can disagree with elements of what they do. You can have different politics from Angela Merkel or different politics from Margaret Thatcher. But they're doing the job. They're disproving all the predictions about women throughout history, including that whole historical period that Dr. Hamlin is
Well, let's go to Kimberly. Right. Now, Kimberly, this is something you in particular have talked about. And one of the mm-hmm. studies that you mentioned in your book came from Harvard in terms of how women's education got derailed. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, sure. I think you're talking about the book by Harvard professor and Dr. Edward Clark called Sex and Education, or A Fair Chance for the Girls.
Yes.
From 1873. So this is very resonant with our discussions about women's periods and whether or not they can do certain things. So in the 1870s, a big national debate, as well as kind of the women's rights debate, was whether or not women could or should go to college. And this debate was raging at Harvard. To help answer this question, Dr. Edward Clark published this book called Sex and Education, in which he argued that it would be terrible for women to go to college because college coincided with vital years in their reproductive development. And put simply, he said, the bodies and minds cannot functionate, he said, at the same time. So if women went to college while having their periods, their reproductive systems would be destroyed. And he warned that a third gender would develop, a sexless class of women who were, you know, very masculine and were no longer able to have babies. And now this, we're sort of laughing today, but this was, you know, the book.
Yeah, how's he doing with that hypothesis?
So
But that specter, that specter of the woman who has male qualities, has long been the sort of nightmare of a number of men. But it's not just men. And I wanted to play this clip from Emma Watson. But before I do, I want to turn the conversation to the women themselves that accept the limited scope of where society has historically put them, the women who resist feminism. So this is Emma Watson. Many people know her for playing Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter movies, but she spoke at the United Nations last year when she was appointed the UN Women Goodwill Ambassador, and this is about gender equality.
Fighting for women's rights has too often become synonymous with man-hating. If there is one thing I know for certain, it is that this has to stop. For the record, feminism, by definition, is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities.
So, Roxanne, clearly, if we put it into the terms of one gender has to win, right? If it's a win or lose situation, that makes us understand why men would resist equal rights. But what about the women who resist?
So we live in a world where there's social dominance hierarchies and men are on top, right? And particularly white males. And those in social dominance hierarchies talk about those in inferior spots below the top. And those in those spots are put in those spots and want to stay in those spots. I shouldn't say want. They are pushed to stay in those spots by those at the top, by legitimizing myths like women can't be good leaders and they're not good drivers.
Their period makes them crazy.
Period makes them crazy. And there are all these myths that people buy into, even though data now show that those myths support that those myths are not accurate, right? So we have these gender roles, these gender boxes that we put men and women in. And when women stray out of those gender boxes, so when women are very aggressive, when women try to engender what we would consider typically male traits, they get punished. They get called bitches. They get called all kinds of things to push them back into their gender box. So if I'm going to be punished for going out of my gender box and I'm going to be rewarded for staying in my gender box, what am I going to do? The likelihood of me staying in my gender box and playing the good girl is going to increase, right?
Because you get rewarded for it.
Because I'm going to get rewarded by all sorts of things, and I'm not even going to know it, right? Because socialization is the water that we're living in, and it's like the fish. They don't know they're in the water until they're plucked out of it. So I'm living this way thinking these are conscious decisions and choices when it's really based on how I'm socialized in my family, in my school, in my church, in my country.
All right, so Mel, let's kind of lay out your argument for why women at this point are destined to become the superior gender. Let me have you restate that premise and then we'll have everyone react to it. So what makes you think that women are destined to tip that balance now?
Because I think we are at a tipping point. I think that the decline of the need for male physical strength and the decline of the value placed on violence and defense and war and preparation for war. I'm not saying we don't need defense. I'm not saying we don't need armies and that there aren't dangers in the world. Obviously there are, but we're not living in a medieval world of constant warring tribes and nations where you needed physical strength to protect you. If you were a woman, you better be attached to a man who could beat up the other men who were coming after you. As Roxanne said, also the men at the top have lots of male victims of different color, of different social status and
sexual orientation,
orientation and so on. So women are victimized, but men too. Why now? Because you accumulate a certain number of women. We have girls growing up now in Brazil and Argentina and Thailand and Germany and England and I hope pretty soon in the United States, seeing the leader of the country in each case is a woman, and girls have an identity and they say, I can be that, instead of just seeing women who are waitresses and nurses and. They see women who are doctors. Half of the doctors are women now, or the at least the ones coming out of medical school. I can be a doctor, and my office is full of young women who are planning to become doctors, and I've followed them, many of them, as they do that. Certain barriers, certain glass ceilings have been broken, and there's no going back. Others have not yet been broken, but as
they've only been cracked. But let me ask you this: does this mean then that the genders flop? That if women become dominant, that suddenly we're leaving men to where women are suppressing men? You know, we get used to saying the man's keeping me down. Is that going to be the woman?
Well, I mean, Philip can correct me on the sociological statistics, but I see studies showing that the number of couples in which women are earning more than their male partners, women are better educated than their male partners, is rising steadily, and it looks like it's going to continue to rise. Certainly, the majority of high school graduates are female. The majority of college graduates are female now.
So, Philip, let's correct the statistics if we need to. I mean, as a male, this must be this is scary, right? What he's saying?
No, not for me. I have tenure, but I understand the concern. No, I think it's true and it's not true. I mean, in the long run, we have extremely rapid progress towards gender equality. However, at the present, we still have a lot of gender inequality, right? So even though we have a growing number of women who earn more than their husbands, if you just break it down that way, that's what it looks like. If you look at those couples, we have a lot more couples where the man earns all the income, and very, very few couples where the woman earns all the income. So and similarly, you know, we have 50% of people getting medical degrees are women now. But if you look 10, 20 years into their careers, obviously, there's a lot more men. And that's not just change over time.
Getting the jobs and getting promoted,
That's staying in the job and the challenges.
I agree. I agree with that, Philip.
Right.
But it also means there's a very deep bench.
Exactly. And I agree with that. I think the one way to think about this, I think without disagreeing more than necessary, is to say that the biological influences that Dr. Conner is talking about maybe are in historical terms, they're subtle and slow. And in social terms, we have the influences that we have on the social order are potentially extremely rapid and great. And on the other hand, that also means that the progress we're making is not inevitable. You know, we could without changing the biological argument that Dr. Conner is making at all, we could, for example, hypothetically have a 100-year reversal where everything turned around and men completely put the clamp back down on women. And in the long run, historical terms, that would appear as a blip in world history. Right? I'm not saying that's actually going to happen, but what I'm saying is that wouldn't contradict the biological argument. That is, you can't, with the amount of variation we have and the amount of social influence we have, the biology is not what's determining the situation we have now.
All right. So since we're having this conversation about women, let's give the two women the last word today in our last 5 minutes. Let me go to you, Kimberly. And I just wanted you to respond to this basic premise of one gender establishing dominance over the other. And what's your initial reaction to that?
Well, I react initially as a historian. So what really strikes me about Dr. Conner's arguments is that they really resonate with a lot of the 19th century feminists and women's rights activists that I write about, women who saw in evolutionary theory the end of male dominance, evidence for the natural, if not superiority, then at least equivalence or equality of women, and who in particular were really excited by and motivated by the idea of thinking of humans in terms of the animal kingdom. And this is something that Dr. Conner and others talk a lot about, which is what other examples for domestic labor, for sexual practices, can we find in the animal kingdom? And when you look to the animals, you see tremendous variety and change, and it really sort of denaturalizes patriarchy. So that's one area where I really see a lot of resonance between these arguments and the historical women I write about, and also in terms of the concept of female choice, and that women in evolutionary terms, if not yet in human terms, are the driving factors in choices about with whom to mate and when and how many babies to have.
And if you're talking about, you know, say the praying mantis, you know, whether they slaughter their mate after they're done.
That too. Yeah.
Just to bring it to another disgusting level. Roxanne, let's
bring... actually, they bite the heads off in the middle of mating, and the males keep right on going.
That takes it to another level, Mel.
I don't even know what to say to that.
I know. I'm not going to make you respond to that, Roxanne. But, you know, this does bring up an interesting point to me, which is like lots of people own dogs, for example, right? And we don't think for a second that the female dog has to be retiring and quiet and has to have babies and has to be nurturing. We accept without question our female canine friend who is athletic and aggressive and all of those things, but we don't when it comes to ourselves. How do we get over that?
So there was a part of me that finds Mel's optimism about the superiority of women really compelling, right? But then the psychologist part of me challenges that because I study the impact of discrimination and oppression on mental health. And what we know is that it's really problematic to be on the lower rungs of the hierarchy. And it results in increased depression, increased anxiety, increased hypertension, increased stress. And all those things I don't think we should want for 49% of the population, right? I think we should strive for equality, to have a diversity of voices.
49% is the men, 51% is women.
Correct.
Okay, keep going.
We should strive for a diversity of possibility, a diversity of opinions, because that creates a diversity of solutions, right? A diversity of possible pathways. But I also, I'm a little cautious about the optimism that Mel has because we've seen that small numbers of very dominant groups have oppressed large numbers of other groups. Take apartheid, for instance. So for those in the top, for males, particularly white males, to give up that power is going to take a good chunk of those white males saying, okay, I'm willing to give up that power because power perpetuates power due to legitimizing myths and all these other things, right? So I don't necessarily see that there's this individual drive and that's going to be enough. So I see a woman in power and think I can be that person in power. There are going to be multiple barriers. They're going to be the glass ceiling, the concrete ceiling. If I live at intersections of racial oppression, sexuality oppression, all those things are going to impact my chances. So do I want to be optimistic? Of course I do. I want to think that we're going to end up living in a world where men and women from all sectors of intersectionality, so racialized, men and women, sexual minorities, let's just go beyond men and women, transgendered individuals, will all be at the table and have equal voice and equal power. But the reality is dominance is pretty strong and the privilege creates structures, systemic structures that recreate their privilege and create oppression.
The man is still keeping us down.
So like Dr. King said, the arc of history bends toward justice, but like President Obama said, it doesn't necessarily bend by itself. So
yeah.
One of the main reasons I'm optimistic is because Roxanne is impatient.
We're all impatient, Mel, I got to be honest. I want to thank, what a great discussion we've had. The hour has flown by. That is Dr. Melvin Connor. He's a professor of anthropology and in the Department of Neuroscience and Behavioral Biology at Emory University. His book is called Women After All, and it kicked off this conversation. It's available now. You also heard Roxanne Donovan, a psychology and interdisciplinary studies associate professor at Kennesaw State University. Kimberly Hamlin is the Director of American Studies at Miami University, and Philip Cohen teaches sociology at the University of Maryland. Thanks to all four of you.
Thank you.
This was a blast. Thank you.
And we want to invite you guys to join the conversation. Call us at 404-500-9457, tweet us, or Facebook us. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.